Periander, excerpts from the Lives. Periander, the son of Cypselus, was born at Corinth of the family of the Heraclidae. His wife was Lycida, whom he called Melissa. Her father was Procles, tyrant of Epidaurus. Her mother, Eurysthenia, daughter of Aristocrates and sister of Aristodemus, who together reigned over nearly the whole of Arcadia, as stated by Heraclitus of Pontus in his book on government. By her, he had two sons, Sepsilius and Lycophron. The younger, a man of intelligence, the elder, weak in mind. However, after some time in a fit of anger, he killed his wife by throwing a footstool at her, or by a kick when she was pregnant. Having been egged on by the slanderous tales of concubines whom he afterwards burnt alive. Aristippus, in the first book of his work on the luxury of the ancients, accuses him of incest with his own mother, Crassia, and adds that when the fact came to light, he vented his annoyance in indiscriminate severity. Euphorus records his declaration that if he won the victory at Olympia in the chariot race, he would set up a golden statue. When the victory was won, being in sore straits for gold, he despoiled the women of all the ornaments which he had seen them wearing at some local festival, and thus was enabled to send the votive offering.
I am he as you are, he as you are me, and we are all together. See how they run like pigs from a gun, see how they fly. I'm crying, sitting on a cornflake, waiting for the van to come. Corporation t-shirt, stupid bloody Tuesday man, you've been a naughty boy, you let your face grow long.
Periander, Minneapolis, 2000. In July of 1900, a census taker had been assigned to the Minnesota Soldier Home, a brick and limestone castellated dormitory of three-story buildings, which stood, still stand, in isolation amongst 3 acres of dense oak woodland on the bluff of the western shore of the Mississippi River, above the gorge of the Minnehaha Creek, which runs through its grounds. Near the quaint Victorian train depot that then serviced the municipal trolley was, and still is, a memorial restoration of Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's New England home in the well-appointed municipal park of Minneapolis, nearby the famous Minnehaha Falls, that always drew, and still draws, tourists and picnics, though it was that summer a stale, flat, and tepid trickle. The Longfellow Cottage, a two-thirds replica of the original, contains the poet's purported bed, his purported writing table, his purported books, none of which items actually belonged to Longfellow, nor were ever touched by him. Longfellow's weathered statue that stood, and still stands, a distance from the cottage amongst a trashy snarl of unmown grass and unkempt dead daffodils, like wads of dirty toilet paper, was, and is, generally unvisited, and was, and is, spattered with pigeon droppings. According to microfiche records, which I found in the Walter Library of the University of Minnesota, the Minnesota Soldier Home was then the residence of 362 inmates. 289 of whom were soldiers of the GAR, 49 of whom were regulars or volunteers of the Indian Wars, 23 of whom had served in both conflicts, and there was one person who declared himself a conscript of the War of 1812, to which he had been mustered a mule skinner, he said. But he was demented, and his record was reported to be doubtful. Nevertheless, he was very old and very poor, and under these circumstances, as was the circumstance for all his brothers in arms, the cause was sufficient to warrant approval of his application for his comfort and care. Each interview by this census taker should have conformed to the requisite census data. It should have comprised not more than 16 items of data, depending upon the answers which are received. However, this one and only interview did not conform to this requirement. Each interview should have been completed in not more than 3 minutes. However, this one and only interview continued for 3 days. The interviewee had refused to tell his name. He declared that he was born on July 4th, 1800. The interview began on July 2nd, 1900. The interviewee died during the interview on July 4th, 1900. The interviewee had declared that he expected he would die on that day, 100 years of age, precisely. His death occurred as he had said it would. As he died, he pressed into the interviewer's hands the talisman, as he called it, which he had said had governed his life. The interviewer, taking the talisman with him, left his bedside after he died, and left the soldier's home without completing, nor properly recording, nor faithfully reporting, the census which he had been engaged to complete, including the data of this interview. All names and all data pertaining to the 362 alleged inmates of the soldier home in 1900, as it was evidently given by this census taker, appear to be entirely false and fictitious. None of what is reported concerning these residents is true. All persons reported are not genuine progenitors to any of the eager descendants who have claimed that data in evidence of their generation. It is a phantom root in a tree of life which is insubstantial as shade. All that may be true about the 1900 census data of the Minnesota soldier home, which this census taker falsely reported, is contained in a bundle of notes and artifacts pertaining to this solitary interview on original government stationery, which were found in a shoebox under a bed of one of the cages in the rooming house on the second floor of this Skid Row block above the Union Gospel Mission in the gateway of Minneapolis when it was demolished in 1961. After it had been abandoned, but before the wrecking ball had destroyed it. It is not known to whom these notes had belonged at the time, presumably the resident of that cage. The census taker is not identified in his notes, nor is revealed by any of the artifacts in the shoebox, although his identity might be ascertained otherwise. Herewith are the contents of these notes on U.S. Census stationery. The front of the census form was completed as follows. Census record number 11887. July 2, 1900. Name, refused. Address, Minnesota Soldier Home, Minneapolis, Minnesota. Residents do not acknowledge him, do not know him. This is unofficial address, previously Gateway District, Minneapolis, address refused. Head of household. Race, quote, I believe I must be a Jew because I am certainly cursed, close quote. Age. He declares he will be 100 years of age in 2 days, that is, on the 4th of July. Married, possibly widowed, name refused. Children, 2 sons, names refused, not deceased to his knowledge, ages unknown, addresses unknown. Place of birth and parentage, he began a lengthy explication to wit. The remainder of the notes recorded on the form and on its reverse and on other forms in series, front and back, are writ in a script which is unknown to this writer. However, they shall be revealed shortly. Found in the shoebox were several other items in addition to these cryptic notes, a yellow pencil without eraser, a tricolor printed brochure, and map of the trolley network for the Twin Cities dated June 1900, a lady's white linen handkerchief, neatly folded and clean, with embroidered italic initials VR at a corner of its tatted edge, a 1900 Indian head U.S. penny, and the talisman. The shoebox came to the possession of the laborer who found it, who gave it to his foreman, who gave it to his chief, who put it in the trunk of his car where it stayed with tools and toolboxes and was not removed until the demolition was completed, and his teenage son was required as a chore and a punishment for drinking his father's gin with his friends when his father was out of town to clean out the trunk. This boy put the shoebox in his room. He moved the shoebox with him when he went to college 2 years later. He had been the first to read the notes, but most of the contents were indecipherable, having been largely recorded in shorthand, of which cipher he knew nothing. He took and carried the talisman as his own, although he did not know its significance at the time. The shoebox and its contents obtained a personal meaning for him, however. He kept it with him in his college dorm room and in the first bedroom that he shared with his young wife before they had children, and in the credenza of the first office he was given in the first important position of employment, which he held in a career that was to prove short-lived but significant to him. He had in this position a personal secretary, a position which, like his own, would shortly become obsolete as she would be reassigned to a pool for the use of word processors and subsequently personal computers, where her skills with shorthand would become arcane, like the electric typewriters whose only utility for several years would be to emboss addresses on envelopes, and whose utility would be replaced by laser-printed self-adhesive labels. Wikipedia says, shorthand is an abbreviated symbolic writing method that increases speed or brevity of writing as compared to a normal method of writing a language. The process of writing in shorthand is called stenography, from the Greek stenos, narrow, and graphe, or graphy, writing. It has also been called brachiography from the Greek brachus, short, and tacheography from the Greek tachos, swift, speedy, depending upon whether compression or speed of writing is the goal. When writ, it resembles wormwood, or that is, the engravure, tiny curling grooves of the tracks of that knotworm insect as it eats its way worm-like into the woodwork of, oh, say, a desk belonging to Longfellow. A crosscut of desecrated wood shows such devilish hieroglyphs as this, the Lord's Prayer transliterated into Grieg shorthand, image in the original. In an act of warm personal affection and old-fashioned dutiful service, his secretary, though no longer his personal secretary, translated the shorthand of the census taker's notes during her lunch hours, during which personal unpaid time she related to him, in her usual self-effacing modesty, that she did not eat lunch anyway because she was dieting, and that besides she enjoyed doing it. She employed her previous cast aluminum IBM Selectric 2 with Prestige Elite 12-pitch typing ball, which she had personally moved with her stenography books, pencils, pens, personal stapler, and cellophane tape dispenser when she had been reassigned to the Unisys Word Processing Pool B on the second floor west, to create a typed copy of the transcribed contents in plain English so that at last he could read and understand them. He put this copy, typed upon the obsolete letterhead of that company to which he was then employed, into the shoebox, and took it and all its contents with him when he changed employment. His former secretary herself soon retired after his departure when the employer insisted that she learn to use an IBM PC model 5150 with DOS and Lotus 1-2-3 to enter, store, and print all correspondence, enter office memorandum, expense reports, and inventory of office supplies. Here follows the first portion of those notes as translated by our secretary. Speaks of himself in the third person. Refuses to give his name. He wears the uniform of the GAR, but doubtful he served. Should have been over 60 years of age during the conflict had he served. Does not look a man of 100 years old. But I guess he has the worst half of that many years, and is a man who looks to have lived very hard indeed, bent and busted. Scrabbles his fork about his plate of food like he's chasing it and can hardly get it full on his fork or up to his mouth because he is so badly palsied. He keeps his right hand, which shakes, in his trouser pocket most of the time. He does not want to tell me the name of his wife. He looks at me hard when I bring up the subject. He looks at me suspiciously, angry. I ask him about his father and mother. He says again, he is a Jew. Father's name? I asked him. Amram, he said after a considering pause. Mother's name? I asked. He laughed and winked at me. Were they born in the U.S.? Where were they born? He asked me back. Yes, I said, where were they born? He said, lived with them until he was 14. Then his father told him to get out on account they had too many to feed, and he should go and get his own living by his own self or die for it. I stopped asking questions for the day and put my mind to making notes of what he said, as closely copied to his own speech as I could scribe it, using both sides of our record sheets. He spoke continuously, but intermittently pausing at long length sometimes, as he stared out toward the edge of the bluff onto the screen of oak, into the layers of leaves and branches there, from time to time losing and finding his thoughts again among them, it seemed. I followed his eyes. The leaves did not move in the still hot afternoon. He seemed to hope they would. We surely need the rain, Never do nothing for money. His father said that. Money is like books. It don't mean nothing what somebody else thinks it means. Can't eat it. Can't drink it. Don't grow. Got no use for books nor money. Don't do nothing for money. His father told him to get out as he sat at the table, his whiskey at the one hand, his biscuits and bacon at the other. His mother, washing dishes with her back to the both of them, acts like she don't hear nothing. Never said nothing. He left without saying nothing, neither. He leaves that night, straight out into the very horrible mouth of a horrible big storm, raining buckets and thundering and lightning striking across the sky and afore him. Little ways from home, he finds a man dying right in the middle of the road, in the rain, lightning all around him, and sparking in the man's dying eyes. Strange to be alone in that plenteous rain, dying on the road. Does not speak. Eyes roll around as the storm goes on, and mouth works to speak, but nothing comes out that he can hear. He shoves into his hands this thing, this talisman, and he dies. He takes the talisman and goes to the next town where they might know him, and not so he would work for them. He steals some food is all. They own you that you works for, like a nigger, just a nigger. A nigger is a fellow what was a slave and is a slave. And when he was set free, he works again for the same fellow what was the one what owns him. But now he's paid in misery and money. And he's got less than he got before. He got starvation and misery and some measly money. Got his freedom. Yes, he does. And that ain't no shit at all. You goes down, looks for yourself if you don't believe him. He knows it before he's seen it, but Blue Bill and the flop, he told him about his only pap and how it came when the soldiers set them free. You is free, you old niggers. Free at last. Ain't you glad, they says. And he says his pap died in them same old cotton fields in harness, like a bony-ass, draggled old mule on a hot, swimmy day like this, and shit and starvation and freedom. Yes, sir. A talisman talks. That very night, he got it. He could not sleep with it, talking. Talk and talk, talk and talk. He nearly threw it away. He wants to bury it in the ground to shut it up. But he didn't. He kept it. He listened to what it says. All life long, in his pocket, right here, patting his pants leg. A little later, he ambushes a white man, maybe killed him, maybe not. Got his rifle, his shot, his powder, took some clothes, took his money, left him there. Told people who found him it was Redskins done it. Later, got some Redskins for doing it. Some settlers and he killed three of them and one of their women. And took their knives and some whiskey they'd got from some white man wasn't supposed to give them none. Little later he got out and got over the Ohio and down in the bottoms and got his own place. Fixture, field, and fence, yes, sir. Got a wife. You want to know her name? Don't matter. She's dead, too. Call her Elizabeth, call her Beth. Call her Bess. Call her dead. Got two boys out of that woman. You want names of them too? Call them black or white. Call them good or bad. Call them friend or foe. Call them dead, too. Just know you're right and go ahead, the talisman says.